Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Kulu for that news update. There'll be more news at 7 o'clock. We kick off this final Monday of the month of October with yet another weird law from around the world. This one comes to you courtesy of North Korea. In North Korea, the Bible is considered a symbol of Western culture and therefore not allowed in the country, as it might influence people and potentially convert them. North Korea is so serious about this that at some point there was a lovely Christian lady who had been handing out Bibles within the country who was arrested and subsequently executed. That's the weird law. I don't make them. I'm going to keep trying to find them. You're tuning to the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at Pick n Pay results with the Chief Executive Officer, Sean Summers. We're going to get a sense of what the performance looks like from that business for the first half of their new financial year. Then we've got a conversation with the Head of Research at Citi South Africa, Gina Schumann, taking a look at South Africa coming off the grey list and what that means for us. Then we've got a conversation taking a look at the latest report from Rand Merchant Bank around the investable destinations on the African continent. We're going to take a look at that and particularly where South Africa ranks on that list. We've also got a conversation with the team at 91 taking a look at some new products that they are bringing to market in the near future. And then we're going to wrap up the show with a personal finance conversation taking a look at narrowing the retirement savings gap.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick off the show as we always do with a sense of how markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, to take a look at market movements and see what to make of them. Gary, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Interesting start to the week as we wrap up the month of October. A red start for local counters, but that has a lot to do with the red day that we're seeing on resource stocks.
Yeah, it's resource stocks, but it's primarily the gold miners. And it's really what's been lifting our index over the past, over the past year or so. So if you look at it, the diversified miners actually had a decent day. So we had the likes of BHP Group up 1.62%. We had Glencore up 1.67%. But we had the resource index down over 7% for the day. And you can see all of that pain is coming from the gold miners. I mean, Goldfields down more than 10%. Harmony down 9%. AngloGold also down around 8%. So this is very much an isolated gold story. Or as I say, gold, but gold and platinum. We also had a couple of the platinum miners falling. So Impala down about 5, Volterra also down just over 5. So let's say gold and platinum is where the pressure has been coming through. That dragged our overall top 40 index down 1.7%. And if you contrast that to what's happening in the US at the moment, we've got the S&P 500 up 1% and the NASDAQ up about 1.6. It's certainly not a broad-based decline in indices if you were just looking at the screen, because we had, pretty much the European markets flat for most of the day. So very, very isolated story there. And I think our Rand as well, like also actually having a little bit of the shine taken off it. You're obviously going to talk about us being removed from the grey list a little later on. But that should have potentially strengthened our currency. As it is against the US dollar, we're pretty much flat at 17.23. And I think that could be a little bit of this gold rally unwinding.
Now, Gary, you mentioned that, of course, the moves today seem isolated to a particular sector. I think it's important to remember that the move to the upside was isolated as well. I mean, if I remember correctly, South Africa to date might be in the top three of best performing equity markets year to date. And that is largely driven by the same rally that we're seeing a bit of a cool down on. Now, this cool down doesn't necessarily mean this is the end of the rally, does it?
No, not at all. But it's very difficult to tell. So you're 100% right. So when we did our kind of third quarter update, when you're looking at the year-to-date performance of let's say JSE all share stocks, 9 out of the top 10 are gold and platinum miners. And it's not a small gap either. These stocks are up over 200% because of the operating leverage in the businesses. When you have a gold price running like we've seen, their share prices go absolutely berserk. And, you've got kind of the the next best counters, the likes of Blue Label and MassPass, they're up in kind of like, mid double digits compared to these 200% rallies. So it has been isolated, but to your question of does this mean it's over? That's difficult to tell, because when it's based on something like gold, and we've seen gold dipping below $4,000 an ounce at the moment, we're just a touch below. Gold is a very difficult commodity. I want to say commodity, but a lot of people look at it as a currency as well. But it's very difficult to value because it doesn't necessarily have an intrinsic value. It's not a widely used in industrial as an industrial metal. It's not the same as platinum, where just under half the demand is coming from autocatalytic converters. Gold has value because people perceive it to have value, because we've seen central bank buying, because we've seen flows into ETFs, and because you can't, kind of do a you can't price it, looking at its coupon or looking at the dividend it's paying, and kind of calculating its cost of capital, and you can't work it back. This is, it's very scary at these levels, because it's simply the belief that people have in it, with its, let's say, 1,000-year plus track record, that keeps it propped up. And and when you do get wobbles like we've seen now, you do tend to see kind of more speculative investors withdrawing, and that's why you see the more exaggerated price movements.
Gary, speaking of things people have belief in, the US Fed has their meeting this week, and the market has a belief that we're going to get 2 rate cuts, even though Fed Chair Jerome Powell has not confirmed that in writing anywhere. What are your expectations this week?
Yeah, I think overwhelmingly that we are going to get a 25 basis point cut, and we'll probably get another 25 basis point cut in December as well. So this week we're looking at obviously that drop. I mean, inflation, it's still above the Fed's target, but certainly I think the labor market is in a lot more focus at the moment. So, the kind of rhetoric we've been hearing out of Fed governors is that we are probably going to see a cut, and I mean that is almost fully priced in. Another 25 basis points on the 10th of December is also expected, which will take it down a little bit further. And the time when it starts to, almost stabilize is only the 28th of January meeting. And there's still about a 50% chance they'll cut again as well. So it does look like we're in for much easier monetary policy coming out of the US, at least for the next couple of months.
Someone that would be loving that information would be the president of the United States, in President Donald Trump. He's set to meet with President Xi Jinping of China whilst they are on the same continent. Do you have any expectations of that meeting? Are you looking at anything there? I know the trade war has been kind of in focus around that. Is that something markets are still looking at?
I think it's front and center. I think it's one of the larger economic risks, or certainly the geopolitical risks that we're facing. And we remember how markets reacted to, really the shutting down of trade between the US and China, after the Liberation Day tariffs. Markets were almost in free fall until we saw the taco trade playing out, and the White House backing out of some of the more dire threats. And I think market participants are, to a large extent, discounting the fact that there is going to be a deal, that we're going to see a de-escalation, come Thursday. We've already seen the US and China have agreed a framework on a trade deal, and now it, I suppose, comes down to, what happens on Thursday itself. And I don't, as much as I think, the US president currently likes to make these sweeping announcements, and I'm sure we'll get one out of it. Whether that's going to be implemented as announced, I'm not so sure. And I think most people are expecting, a slow de-escalation of the tension between China and the US, and hopefully a slightly more free flow of goods and services.
Well, we all live in hope, and we have to wait until Thursday to find out what that hope means. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Gary Boyson, the Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, for joining us to get a sense of market movements throughout the day, some expectations ahead of some important meetings this week, and what we make of it all. In a world where a lot can change in 6 years, you can rest assured that Hino's 6-year drivetrain warranty won't. All Hino trucks now come standard with a 6-year drivetrain warranty, protecting your investment all the way from pistons to gears. Built to keep your business moving, supporting uptime, growth, and daily operations. Because although a lot can change in 6 years, our warranty promise won't. Terms and conditions apply. Hino all the way. 7.05 was the time this morning when Pick n Pay Stores Limited released their interim financial results for the 26 weeks ended 31 August 2025. It is the first half of their new financial year's update, and we're going to be taking a look at the numbers with the company's group CEO, Sean Summers. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this performance. Uncle Sean, lovely to have you on the show again. Thanks so much for taking the time. A significant turnaround from a trading profit perspective, which will then feed into trading profit margins. But this is an ongoing process. The last time you and I caught up, we were concluding what had happened with the recapitalization program, the unbundling of Boxer, and we were saying that the ship is slowly but surely getting back on course. 6 months after that, it looks as though we're still staying the course, and it's improving.
Thank you very much, Jimmy, and good afternoon again. And thank you for your support of Pick n Pay. Greatly appreciated. Certainly the journey continues, and all of the plans that we put in place are all being worked at. They're all being implemented. And as I shared this morning in the presentation, with the benefit of hindsight, I can honestly say that there is nothing additional that we would have done some 18 months ago when we launched this plan. I think that we've been in retail long enough to know the levers that are available to us that need to be maneuvered and need to have pressure put on them. And it's a journey. And for us, it's important that it's got to be profound and sustainable. And that's why we're not chasing short-term wins at the expense of medium to long-term impairments or losses. And that's the journey that we're on.
Uncle Sean, you touched on the fact that there are certain levers within the retail space. And I suppose from an executive perspective, with the years of experience that you have at your tender age, it is very difficult to find a CEO that has seen so many different forms of the retail market. How are you reading that retail market at the moment? The consumer is one side of it, but on the other side of it is a business like Pick n Pay that needs to still operate, that needs to still turn itself around. How are you seeing the landscape?
So the landscape, certainly, first and foremost, is that the market is very, very constrained. We have consumers that are under enormous pressure in this country. We can see, you know, wage rates and all of those things are behind the curve. We can see GDPs behind the curve. So all of the macro elements in the marketplace, there's nothing that's working in the favor of the retail market. But it's the same for all of us. You know, my opposition sitting in their offices are confronted with the exact same conundrum that we are sitting with. They're just not in the situation of turning around a company in this marketplace. So that certainly doesn't make it any easier. So, you know, I had to go and address the business rescue and insolvency practitioners on Friday. They had their annual congress. And, you know, I said, a business turning around at scale in a marketplace like this, there are certainly nothing that's sort of lining up to help us in this regard. But one can't cry about it. You know, the market is the market. You have to accept it for what it is. And then you've got to work out what you can do within that to actually improve your business. And that's why we're very happy that the store closure cycle, the stores that we'd identified that we needed to get rid of, we're kind of 95% of the way through that. So now we can focus on all of the positivity of the good stuff that's happening in the company. And I'm very pleased with the rate of our like-for-like sales growth, which is extraordinary if you consider that, you know, we are so many less stores in the company and our opposition has all continued to open stores at pace. And notwithstanding that, we still managed to grow our like-for-likes. So that's something that we will keep focusing on. Very pleasing to see that our customer like-for-like footfall is even above our like-for-like sales. So that is a really, really positive thing, and that's what we need to keep growing.
So customers are clearly starting to return back to Pick n Pay stores and starting to gain a little more confidence in the business. Alongside that, if we look at the numbers from a profitability point of view, there was that billion rand loss that we spoke about in the previous cycle, and following the recapitalization plan and some of the changes, as you said, that loss has narrowed down to less than 400 million rand at the moment. It's almost a 70% improvement. Are we optimistic that by the full year's end we might even be in a profitable position here?
No, we're not going to be that quick, Jimmy. As I've said, a lot of that beneficiation has come through the change in our balance sheet. You know, our balance sheet was really, really upside down. And with the listing a year ago, that allowed us to remedy that. So we've had interest income this year as opposed to massive interest paid last year. The beneficiation from the underlying trading situation, you know, with the store closures at a group level, our sales are plus minus flat year on year. So if you got your expenses, although well controlled, still have the effect of inflation in them, that's why you end up with a negative jaws situation, you end up with a negative leverage. So, you know, that's what we need to prize open in the sort of next 12 to 18 months that are ahead of us. And that is what we're on journey to do. It's what we're on course to do. So nobody said this is going to be easy. That was never part of the gig right from the start. But it doesn't make us lose any faith or confidence in the future. In fact, to the contrary, somebody asked me earlier, you know, what is it that keeps me awake at night? And I said the simple thing that I can't wake up and go to work in the morning because there is just still so much to do. There's so much positivity that's flowing through in the organization. It's a totally different company to what it was a year and 18 and 24 months ago.
Speaking of 18 to 24 months, Uncle Sean, before I let you go, I want to get a sense of what lies ahead for the business in the second half of the year. Or where do you continue to focus? Because you and I have had multiple conversations in the past around what this turnaround plan looks like. And we've said this before that it won't be easy, it won't be a quick turnaround solution, but it will be one that's done right. And that seems to be coming through from a numbers perspective. On the roadmap, what lies ahead going into the next 6 months and even beyond that?
So on the roadmap, what lies ahead, I'm very pleased to say that our entire restructure of our supply chain has been agreed. MOU was signed at the end of last week, and that's all done. So, you know, when we said we're going to do stuff, we do it. So that's all done and put to bed. As I've said, the store closure program is pretty much done and closed and behind us. So now we're going to be focusing on deploying our capital into our existing real estate that we have, where we still have great stores and great sites. So the next balance of this year, we've got another 15, 16 stores to reopen between now and the festive trading period. And then next year, we will continue that process of putting our capital into existing stores and fixing them up. And obviously focusing on top line sales because, you know, momentum is your friend in business. And we have to ensure that we keep the momentum continuing in the right direction, despite the fact that the market is flat, despite the fact that you've got gambling that's taking all of this money out of the consumers' pockets. It's taking food out of customers' mouths, never mind consumers' pockets. And we know that the more constrained piece of the market are the people who unfortunately are the biggest victims in this current, I call it the new cancer of society. And that's why I certainly believe that there should be a move similar to that that's happened in Belgium, the Netherlands, Italy, where they've in fact banned all online gambling and marketing and promoting, akin to cigarettes. This is a new scourge of our society currently, and it's just beyond comprehension what's currently happening.
Momentum is your friend in business, but it's also important to understand that change does not happen overnight. As long as the business remains focused, that is what will get it through. We'll leave this conversation on that note and we'll catch up at the end of the year. Thank you so much to the Chief Executive Officer of the Pick and Pay Group, that is Sean Summers, for joining us to take a look at their first 6 months of the year and what the next 6 months could potentially look like.
I think it's time for an adventure. We could visit the grandkids, check on a London apartment while we're there, or we could meet them in Dubai and look at properties along the way.
Why settle in one place when you can be a global citizen? If it's on your mind, it's on ours. Partner with a wealth banker who will connect your global banking, lending, and investments on a single platform. See money differently. Nedbank Private Wealth. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We have finally made it, folks. We have finally been taken off of the naughty list. I'm referring to the grey list that we sat on as a country for a little around 32 months from when we were listed in February of 2023. And now that we're off of the grey list, we're going to be taking a look at just what that means for the Republic of South Africa. I'm joined on the line by the head of research at Citi South Africa, Gina Schoeman, to take a look at this and see what you make of it. Gina, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. I suppose we'd been preparing for this moment. We had been all but awaiting this, but it is good to finally have that confirmation from the Financial Action Task Force that we are no longer a grey-listed country?
Yes, absolutely. If you think about it in that South Africa is unfortunately carrying quite a lot of stains to its reputation from, you know, more than a decade now of the state capture years, the corruption, the lack of reform, and this was added to that list. So it's a very good thing to remove that so that the list is shorter. And I must say, as much as it was expected, it is quite quick to exit the grey list within 32 months. So I do think that the sense around this removal from the grey list is a positive one and should have positive multiply effects down the line.
Gina, before we get into those positive multiply effects, let's perhaps look at why we were making such a big fuss about coming off of this grey list. What does this actually mean for a country like South Africa? We weren't the only ones to be removed from the grey list. The likes of Nigeria and Mozambique were also taken off the grey list. What does this actually mean in the scheme of global economics and global trade?
Well, so every country has, very broadly speaking now, a country risk premium. And that country risk premium will be made up of many aspects, one of which would be grey listing if you're on the grey list, but it'll be also made up of other things such as anyone's perceived measure of political uncertainty. It'll be made up of where your investment grade is by the sovereign rating agencies. So you have all sorts of factors that add to a country risk premium. And that country risk premium then determines how far away you are from your fair value. Now, often when we talk about fair value, we're coming down to the currency. So if the rand dollar's fair value right now, by all sorts of different measures, could be anywhere between, you know, 14 to 16 against the dollar, well, why is it then higher than fair value? Why is it weaker than fair value? It's because of the risk premium that is perceived on the country. So the gray list would be adding to that. So by removing a country off the grey list, the country risk premium comes down and you have a better chance of your bond yield, so your debt servicing costs, your currency, moving back to what is effectively just a fairer assessment without all of these stains to the reputation. And if you think about a grey list also from a transactional perspective, if you are on the grey list, it means that financing transactions in a country are peppered with uncertainty. And that doesn't really leave any investor more certain that they'll get a good rate on their return, no matter what type of investment that is. So if you remove yourself off the grey list, then, of course, you have a better chance of attracting investment.
Now, Gina, we know that coming off of the grey list does not necessarily mean, well, does not necessarily equate to coming out of something like junk status from an investment point of view. So just because we're no longer grey listed does not guarantee we will receive inflows from outside capital. I want to take a look at that and perhaps look at it from the perspective of what it does for reputation and integrity and reliance that the international market then places on countries that are no longer on the grey list, or even countries that are able to come off as quickly as we have. Because I think on the African continent, barring Mauritius, this might be a new record in terms of coming off that list.
Yes, absolutely. So I think a good comparison here would be, you know, what you said about the rating agencies. So in the event you get put into junk status, a country like South Africa did recently, we fell out of what was known as the World Government Bond Index, which meant as a country, you just get wiped off it. And suddenly those flows that you were enjoying, those are passive flows. They come to you anyway. These are not investors scrutinizing South Africa. These are investors who have invested in the World Government Bond Index. And if a country is no longer in that, it cannot enjoy that ongoing, consistent inflow of investment flows. And that's why this is not as meaningful or sudden as, let's say, a sovereign ratings change. If you're removed off the grey list, the benefit is not going to be the sudden inflow of investment, but it is going to facilitate or accelerate more transactions. It's going to guarantee more transactions. So it's almost a slow trickle over time to get back to where we were. It's a relief for anyone who is operational or wanting to be operational from a financing perspective. And that, again, is a positive for South Africa because it's actually a long-term benefit.
Gina, we might find that we are feeling the relief now. But how important is it to not get back onto the grey list? The last thing we want to do is move one step forward and then 10 steps backwards. What do we need to do from a country perspective to ensure that we don't do that?
So it's absolutely imperative that once you've moved off the grey list, that you don't move back onto it, because you're just going to undo all of the credibility you enjoyed. In other words, what South Africa has shown now is that it has quite quickly, in 32 months, addressed all 22 action items that SATF, who put us on the grey list, told us to address. And that means that we can now prove ourselves. But our credibility will increase as long as we can stay off the grey list. You know, we effectively need to get to a point where people forget that South Africa was once grey listed. Because if you suddenly get grey listed quite soon after that, then you're going to lose credibility. It's going to mean people are going to look at South Africa and say, okay, well, this was an area of reform. Well done, you did it. But now that reform's gone backwards. So, you know, how certain should we be that every time you take that one step forward, that you're not just going to fall back, depending on who's in charge, depending on taking your eye off the ball. So this is really just about credibility. You need to stay off that grey list, not go back onto it, because I think also once you go back onto it, to try and get off it again, it's going to come with less credibility. And maybe if you come off it a second time, it's going to create more question marks about, okay, they're off it for a second time. Maybe they'll just go on it a third time. So we have to stay off it. And that's actually, this is where the hope sits, is that the things that have been put in place to get off the grey list arguably may have insulated and strengthened South Africa's capabilities for those 22 action items then before we got grey listed. It's a bit, again, like a sovereign rating. It's very hard to get out of junk status. It is far more difficult to get upgraded than it is to get downgraded. So once you have been upgraded, you really have proved yourself. And I think that's what the hope is about getting off this grey list and also getting off it, as I said, you know, fairly soon, far quicker than what a lot of countries suffer.
We may be off the grey list, but the Rand is going to take a little bit more from a risk sentiment perspective for that risk premium to start to come down. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Gina for those insights and for the time. Lovely having you on the show. Gina Schoeman, Head of Research at Citi South Africa, joining us to take a look at South Africa coming off the grey listing.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So Rand Merchant Bank has released their latest Where to Invest in Africa report, taking a look at the African markets, investment destinations on the African continent, and what destinations make sense. I'm joined on the line by the chief economist at Rand Merchant Bank, Isaiah Mhlanga, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Mr. Mhlanga, always lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. So where do we invest in Africa?
Look, Africa is a collection of 54 odd countries, but what we look at in this report, we look at 31 markets that constitute 90% of Africa's GDP. So you would, cover much of the continent. And if you look at this year's rankings, which takes into account, a lot of variables under four pillars, we have economic performance and potential under pillar one, that's 35% of the ranking. We have market accessibility and innovation, that's 20% of the ranking. We have economic stability and investment climate, that's 25% of the ranking. And then we have the social and human development, that is 20% of the ranking. These are factors that have proven over time that they determine investment attractiveness. And we amalgamate them into one ranking that gives us a point view of which countries we should be looking at. But what we also need to take into account is there are always investment opportunities of different types in different countries, despite the rankings. That we must always keep at the back of our mind. So in this year's rankings, we have the top five that have maintained their rankings from last year. We have Seychelles and Mauritius as number one, number two. Small economies, but they do very well in terms of all the other aspects except the economic potential, which is the size of the economy to a large extent. And then number three and four, that's Egypt and South Africa. And then number five is Morocco. That's those countries, they maintained their top rankings in the top five. Big movers, Nigeria, declined 9 points, but that is because of the devaluations that we saw in the Naira, but we also saw a restatement of Nigeria's GDP, which meant that the decline that we have seen is because of economic reforms that are necessary to make the economy more resilient. So they declined for the right reasons, which means they set the base for better growth in future.
Isaiah, speaking of growth, let's look at the African growth story. What seems to be driving that story in international markets? I mean, we know that the African continent has got its own challenges and positives, and this is what investors look at when they look at making investment decisions. What is the African growth story at the moment?
Many African countries have been doing economic reforms for quite some time. Part of the story that I was speaking about that we see in Nigeria, the devaluation essentially eliminating the parallel markets in the FX market, but also removing fuel subsidy, fuel subsidies that made a negative impact from a fiscal policy perspective. All of those reforms, they are quite positive. In our own economy in South Africa, where you see the reform process taking place, energy availability is better. We're starting with logistics. We are now off the grey list because of the reforms. So you see those reforms. And then in the likes of Zambia, the debt restructuring that we have seen, and also in Ghana. So a number of countries have done economic reforms that are necessary. But we also have a commodity price story lately that is, around the critical minerals, but also because of the global risks and uncertainties that we see out of the U.S., which have meant that precious metals that we export as, to a large extent, Africa, have made many, many economies to perform very well. So it's underpinned from a reform perspective. Those are homegrown, responses to make sure that economies are resilient. But also there are external shocks that have been positive. All those combined have meant that we are seeing better expected growth. And by the way, Africa is the second fastest growing continent after East Asia, which means these are quite robust growth rates that we are seeing. Only if we could maintain, we could deal with some of the social issues that we have, such as unemployment and inequality.
I was just going to come to that as our closing conversation, Isaiah, is how are we stacking up globally and what does that then mean for capital allocations? Because in a world where asset allocators are always seeking out returns, you do start to want to look at where you're going to get growth and long-term growth in the future.
From a growth perspective, there is a positive outlook on Africa. But on emerging markets and developing economies in general, there are these future sources of economic growth that are much more better relative to advanced economies. You see, advanced economies have a lot of fiscal issues. You look at the US, you look at Germany, Japan, the UK, their debt to GDP ratios are quite high. Long-term bond yields are rising. So you are starting to see a shift preferring, you know, to invest in emerging markets because the growth prospects are looking better while the risks in the advanced economies are elevated. So that shows you that investors are increasingly, you know, looking at Africa as an investment destination, but we're still behind Asia from a growth perspective, which is why we need to continue to do the reforms to make sure that our growth is underpinned by the right infrastructure backdrop.
Africa continues to tell a growth story and continues to be an attractive investment destination as a continent. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the chief economist at Rand Merchant Bank, Zion Mhlanga, for joining us to take a look at the latest Where to Invest in Africa report.
What's the secret to turning on success? Easy. The right partnership. With Telkom Business, get solutions that elevate your business. A reliable internet connection that keeps your team on track. Get fiber, an integrated unified communications tool. Get cloud PABX, connectivity that keeps up with the festive rush. Get unlimited LTE.
This summer, your business deserves the best. Visit telkom.co.za/business for deals that grow your business. T's and C's apply. Telkom Business. Possible begins here.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by 91, investing for a world of change. With investment decisions taking different shapes and forms every day, investment managers are having to look into their bag of tricks and pull out some innovative and useful solutions that consumers can use. We're going to be taking a look at the latest developments from the team at 91 to see what it is that they're bringing to the market. I'm joined on the line by the head of SA Unit Trusts at 91, Siobhan Simpson, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Siobhan, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. So rumor has it, 91 is stepping into the actively managed ETF space. That's a very interesting space. Why enter that space in this particular way? I mean, actively managed ETFs are quite a different product set, but nevertheless, they do require the same level of skill set, I imagine.
Yes, it's very exciting. Jimmy, thanks very much for having me this evening. We've actually got our listing scheduled for the middle of November, and it really represents a milestone for our South African business, bringing nearly 35 years of active investment expertise into this listed, accessible format. Our goal is always to help clients stay diversified, liquid, and invested, even in these uncertain markets. So no matter what wrapper the client uses, you're able to access our expertise. And really, this is just another example about how we continue to evolve with the investor needs, this time obviously bringing this active edge to the listed market. You spoke about why the ETF space now and really what's happening globally. If we can probably start with the difference, I mean, I think there's a big misnomer between, you know, traditional ETFs, which are passive, they really track an index and mirror that index's performance, while actively managed ETFs, they really are dynamic. Our investment teams adjust portfolios, you know, based on their research, their valuations, and the market opportunities to outperform their benchmarks.
So Siobhan, when we look at the global landscape and the South African market as well, there are changes happening. There are changes in fundamentals. There are changes in how markets are responding to volatility. How does that then influence, from a portfolio management point of view and an asset management point of view, the decisions that are made behind managing ETFs?
Look, I think we need to start with the difference between traditional passive ETFs, which everyone sort of goes to first. Those just track an index and there's really no active decision in it. With actively managed ETFs now, they're dynamic. Our investment teams are making the decisions based on their research, their valuations, the market opportunities to outperform their benchmarks in these challenging times, which you speak about, Jimmy.
Siobhan, what are you seeing happen globally at the moment? From an asset management point of view, there are a lot of moving parts, I'd imagine. And you've touched on this to say that it's why things that are happening globally start to influence how the asset managers are actively managing their ETFs. What are you seeing from a trends perspective that might be influencing these moves?
Look, globally, ETFs are around $18 trillion. And they're expected to reach about $25 trillion in the next sort of 4 years, which is a huge amount. active ETFs are actually the fastest growing segment of this ETF market. Nearly half of all new ETF launches last year were active strategies. And really, they combine, the reason this is happening is they're combining the ETF efficiency with actively managed solutions. And what is that ETF efficiency? It's about intraday trading, transparency, and liquidity. And it really just helps investors navigate that market. If we bring it back to South Africa, passive ETFs have been around for years, but importantly, regulatory changes in the last 2 to 3 years have now allowed for active management within this ETF space. It's creating the right environment for innovation of products and ultimately growth in the space, because currently in the ETF space in South Africa, only 6% is actually active.
So, Siobhan, tell us about the ETFs that 91 will be bringing to market. I know I might be jumping the gun a little bit. I know this might be sensitive information, but perhaps give our listeners and our community a bit of an understanding around how 91 has gone about selecting these particular products that are coming to market and why starting with these ones.
Yeah, so we're launching two. The first is our 91 Diversified Income Actively Managed ETF. It's a RAND-based, Regulation 28 compliant, focused on generating reliable income and preserving capital. It's multi-asset income, which means it invests in some cash, some bonds, and a little bit of offshore. If you think about a yield, it's currently yielding just below 9%. And really, it's a good solution for investors that are either waiting on the sidelines for a market entry point, or if you've got a lot of cash in your portfolio that you want to sweat a little bit harder. The second is an offshore version of that. It's called the 91 Global Diversified Income Actively Managed ETF, and it's a RAND feeder into our global US dollar income fund. So clients that are looking for, you know, they're becoming increasingly more globally weighted. You need to be a little bit risk aware. You don't want to necessarily go into global equity markets. This is the perfect opportunity to make that also offshore cash sweat a little bit harder with a yield just below 5% at the moment. So those investors who want a global, diversified offshore cash solution as such.
Siobhan, as we wrap up the conversation, let's look at how ETFs are creating greater accessibility to markets. Because for a lot of retail investors, they prefer ETFs where they can't access an asset manager or they can't access some of the products of asset managers like 91. 91 is a global asset manager, and I'm sure there's some products that retail investors don't even know about. But this, the introduction of things like actively managed ETFs looks to bridge that gap.
Yeah, I think if we think about some of the trends that are driving the rise globally, Jimmy, you know, you've got things like there's a number of increased sort of alternatives that you can invest in, as well as the other benefits, you know, ease of access, lower minimums, that makes them really appealing to a new generation of investors. You know, young digital first investors are drawn to the simplicity of trading on apps and online platforms. And then we know that there's this huge intergenerational wealth transfer underway. So these younger tech savvy heirs are really favoring ETFs for the transparency and control. And it's not about just age. We're all so used to a seamless customer experience in other areas of our life, like online shopping and banking, using apps to do just about everything in your life and then watching the progress on the app. And really, actively managed ETFs allow us to do this in the investment landscape now.
Creating greater accessibility towards investments and ensuring that investors are able to access the very best that asset managers have to offer. That is what 91 intends to do with their actively managed ETFs set to be launched imminently. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the head of SA Unit Trusts at 91, Siobhan Simpson, for giving us some insight around what it is we can expect. This feature was brought to you by 91, investing for a world of change.
We can stay here, stick with what worked before, keep our eye on that one spot, steadfast. Or we can recognize that the only constant is change. At 91, we believe that with change comes opportunity. That's why we have 250 investment professionals in the world's investment hubs actively seeking opportunities for you, wherever in the world they may be. Isn't it time to change how you see investing? Invest offshore with 91. 91. Investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's personal finance time on a Monday. We're going to be taking a look at closing the retirement savings gap. It's a gap that seems to be growing ever increasingly when we look at some of the decisions that need to be made going into retirement, especially with people living longer into retirement. I'm joined on the line by consulting actuary at NMG Benefits. That is Natasha Hagatenshi, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Natasha, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. What seems to be causing the widening of the retirement savings gap?
Good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to your listeners. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, I think the widening is a couple of factors. When pension funds were first started, the retirement age was 65 and people expected to die at 66 or 67. Now the retirement age is 65 and people are expected to die at 85. You know, so it's a lot longer that we need to live off our money. And people are also not, and particularly us South Africans, we're not good committed savers. That is we're not saving enough and we're living too long and needing to live too long off our money.
Natasha, alongside that, part of that is there's also a pay gap. And I mean, we've had these conversations in the past around gender pay gaps and how women are not paid at the same pay scales as men. We've been trying to narrow that pay gap. But the reality of that pay gap is then it means then that one party has less to save from the onset and less to prepare with for retirement than another party, just simply because of that.
Absolutely. So, yeah, no, definitely women, you know, with taking career breaks for child rearing, for whatever, definitely have that, you know, A, they've just missed out. They've potentially cashed out, you know, when you go on maternity leave, you cash out your, you resign from your job, cash out your money. So, you know, you're starting again. And then off a lower base pay, a contribution is lower than someone earning a higher salary. So absolutely, there is that problem. And how do we breach it is hard, and it takes commitment and biting down and making those extra contributions.
Let's look at some of those how to breach techniques, Natasha, and perhaps some of them are little habits, little changes that can be made. Some of them are things like increasing your contributions. Can you just take us through perhaps some of the practical things that someone can, if I'm looking for a 5-point plan, for example, and I'm looking to say, what are the things I can do right now that are simple, practical, that don't need me to think about, that might improve my retirement savings at the end of the day?
Okay. So the first thing I think to do is to look at where you're spending your money. And actually, I'm not going to say cut out your daily latte, but look at what insurances you have. Look at if you are overinsured. Many people are overinsured. You've actually got a group life benefit. You are older. Your kids are out of the house. You're still insuring for, you know, assumption that they're 4 or 5 and you've got to provide for them for 20 years. So look at that. See where you could make those savings. And, you know, on your personal insurance lines, whatever, all of your other products, and channel that saving into retirement benefits. So that's number one. Number two, don't take a 2-pot claim. It's very nice. It's very accessible. It's very easy to have. And as NMG, we're very much in favor of the 2-pot as an overall system, because it's going to force people to get their money in time, or you know, have more savings in time. But yeah. Only use your 2-pot for an emergency. So that's number three. Number three, look at your spending patterns and don't get devastated if you've missed out and you've been behind, you've stopped working, whatever. Make those extra contributions where you can, and particularly when it comes to your 13th check, your annual bonus or whatever. Pay yourself first and put some of that bonus into your retirement fund, and you can do that either through making use of what they call additional voluntary contributions or into your own personal retirement annuity. And you know, the nice thing is that our government is very generous to us. You know, for depending on your tax bracket, you know, if you put 100 rand in, you're either getting between 45 rand or 30, 21 rand, 18 rand back as a contribution from the government as a tax break. So use that. For later, people in South Africa, we've got this, you know, we're going to clock off at 50. You know, but if you're living till 80, that's a long time to live on your own money. Plan to retire later. You know, every year that you save more is 1 year less that you've got to live off your pension. And so you actually get a two-year gain in terms of your winnings. I think have a look at your pensionable salary. Often we caught short because we think we're paying a contribution on the 100 rand we're earning, but actually we're only paying a contribution on the 50 rand that we're earning. Up. And as I said, you know, where other things, as you pay off your bond, that contribution can go into paying your retirement savings. So just look for avenues to increase it, because the more that goes in and the longer it goes in, the better at the end of the day.
Natasha, what about the growing trend that we've seen where younger individuals are starting to make different retirement decisions? We've seen that with the change of generations. A lot of the younger generations seem to be living more for the now and the immediate and thinking less around retirement, not just in South Africa. This seems to be happening globally, according to some of the research. Is that something that should be changing and individuals should be taking into account the retirement age, especially, as you said, that we are living longer?
So I was going to say that I think the answer to that question is a two-part thing around that our retirement fund system kind of wants us to be employed. You know, there's this kind of you belong to an employer fund, and that link needs to be broken, and we really need to get much more focus on individual products and individual products that don't compel you to sign up for a fixed monthly contribution. You need to be able to contribute while you're working, stop contributing while you're not working, contribute double while you've got, you know, two of your jobs in the gig economy. So we need to, our retirement system needs to be much more adaptable. And I think unfortunately for the lesson for is that you still need to, you know, pay yourself first. Make sure that your first 10% of your salary goes towards a retirement contribution for the long term.
Narrowing the retirement gap is what is important, especially from a savings perspective, given that people are set to live longer. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Natasha Hagatenshi, who is the consulting actuary at NMG Benefits, for joining us for our personal finance segment.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, you know exactly where you can catch up on them. We are going to get ready to cross back to the SAFM news team. Before we do, a quick look at the gold price. I've been keeping an eye on that throughout the show. We are almost back at $4,000 a fine ounce. I'll keep an eye on it and report back tomorrow to see if we go back above that key level. But for right now, it is coming up to 7 o'clock.